We made this.
Everyone, and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green Is People. I am your host for this week, Kurt North, and with me to talk about this episode is Russ Hugo. Russ, how are you doing today?
Doing great, actually. I'm really looking forward to chat with you.
Pleasure to have you back on. We were just saying off air, I think that the last time you were on was for A Single Blade of Grass.
Correct.
And so we joked off air that you seem to be for the X-Cast and for The Time Is Now, you seem to be our racial expert.
I'm the one who's so excited to talk with other humans that will take the risk of potentially alienating and offending millions of listeners by tackling these more potentially controversial or problematic elements.
I think we'll stick with problematic. I think we'll stick with that. So we are going to be talking about Siren today, which is season 2, episode 17. So we are getting to the close of season 2, and it's been a fantastic season that we've had so far. This episode itself aired on the 20th of March 1998 and was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong. It was directed by Alan Coulter. Now, it's interesting that Alan Coulter's been on a few little bits that I've done recently. He did All Souls on the X-Cast, on the X-Files, which I covered on the X-Cast as well. So he's been popping up a few bits here and there of late, so that's good to see him. But this episode sees a mysterious woman who appears to a full ship of smuggled immigrants, and the various mysterious things start to occur, and different elements kind of pick up, and people have got different stories to tell regarding what she's doing on that ship and how she got on there. So, Russ, just before we delve into the episode, what are your general thoughts on this? What would you rate out of 10, and how have you foreseen, now that we're getting towards the end of season 2, The middle arc up until this point, we've got just past Owls and Roosters, for example. We've done things like Luminary, and we've gone through the whole Goodbye Charlies and all that kind of thing. Where do you see the season at this point, and just your general thoughts on this episode?
General thoughts first to start there on the episode. I have not watched this episode probably since my initial watch of it, because I, for some reason, was not too impressed by it or too interested in revisiting it until for this podcast. And watching it this time was a bit shocked. A, there are some things to like about it, but B, how much it has in common with The Sound of Snow. And I can't believe I missed that, but I guess probably because I watched it before I watched Sound of Snow in a space of there. So this could alternatively titled The Sound of Water in some senses, but we can maybe get into some of the parallels there later and explore those. I think it works fairly well at the point it is in the season when it comes to Frank Black's journey and position. It's a little redundant post-Luminary in a few things, but it does still shift the direction on the upswing back to family reunification and some things like that. It's great to have Catherine back in the show a little bit more. So there's some things in the sense of the arc related. That's sort of my summary and takeaway. Oh, and my rating. Yeah. Ooh, I'm going to probably put it right in the middle. I had a recollection. We're going to have to hash this out a bit. I had a recollection of the episode having a lot more issues than actually I think it does. I think it does have some issues, but I think it also has some things going for it. And so I'm probably going to get it a 5 out of 10, just right in the middle, or maybe a 4.5. Let me put it there. It attempts some things, it's decent, and there are some problems. But it's still, it's worth watching.
Yeah, and you generally skew your rating slightly differently to what a lot of people would do as well, don't you? Can you just reiterate how you kind of view that?
I definitely, yeah, thank you. I like to skew things on an actual curve so that there are some zeros and there are some tens, as opposed to the IMDb where it's more like 7 to 9 and something like that. And so in relation to season two, I would put this at around the middle, lower end of the middle of the pack of episodes.
The IMDb score for it is 7.1. So that places it, just so you're aware, that places it as, let's have a look, about 4 from the bottom. In and around Amnesis, Single Blade of Grass, Sense and Antisense, and Incardia Ego. That's the kind of company it's keeping at the moment.
There's a lot of commonalities in those episodes.
there is absolutely. So yeah, so there's so it does feel for me. I tend to do the IMDb rating as much. It's very rare I would give anything a 5 really, and I would my lower end is kind of more of a 6. This is an episode when I watched the rewatch that I did before coming show running this show. I did a rewatch around about 2 years ago now. I could not for the life of me remember what Siren was, apart from vague recollection of the ship, and there was some form of ghostly kind of issue happening, and I couldn't really remember anything beyond that. And then rewatching it again now, I would say the same as you. I think in my rewatch, I thought that there was some potential issues that I had with it overall, but on watching it today, I actually think that it's probably isn't that bad an episode, and I would maybe go for a 6.5-7 out of 10. Yeah, so but you mentioned about things like Catherine and her familial arc. It's something that I'm going to ask you when we deeper into the episode. But as you were saying then and alluding to with the likes of like Luminary, for example, and Owls and Roosters, and where do you find this part of the season as we're running? Because we've had a big 2-part mythological episode in Owls and Roosters just before this, and we are heading quickly on to, Somehow Satan Got Behind Me is kind of a separate one in case, but we're heading into The Time Is Now and The Fourth Horseman. So where do you see the arc right now?
I'd love the energy that is building and the payoff of season two. There are some qualms that I expressed in the podcast about evil and some of the rest. And all the things we love, there are flaws, and so I'm not going to dismiss those. But overall, there's a lot of great energy. Similarly, I have some issues with Owls, more so than Roosters. That relates also, I think, to Morgan Wong's writing of this episode. It kind of comes down to that. There's the ending of Roosters, which I think is one of the best moments of the show. That's set to, I think, Parsifal and the rest, and without any dialogue, and it really kind of ties in so well to where the show is going to be going, mood and atmosphere wise, and taking some risks. Luminary is another thing that probably one of my favorite Millennium episodes that kind of captures what I really like about season two. Owls captures a lot of what I don't like about season two, and some of the writing in this episode is actually kind of goes both ways. Some of the things I like about season two, but then also some of Morgan Wong's habits that don't necessarily gel. And I think it's a lot of the script as opposed to some of the other elements that are dragging. There's in this story something that actually does connect well on the path from Luminary up to the conclusion here that we're heading for season two. But I think it's muddled a little bit by the scripting and a little bit by the acting, which we can get into later. But maybe to kind of sum it up as something that I thought, it's a little bit on the nose, but I think centers the episode where it's supposed to be in Morgan Wong's intentions, is Catherine's opening line when she's there with the client and says to the client and says, "You've been a victim of a terrible loss. You have to give yourself time to grieve." And it's a little bit on the nose, but I'm also going to give it to Morgan Wong and say that's a nice way to introduce the theme, because it's being directed to someone else and we're kind of seeing Catherine again for the first time. So I think that quote right there sums up the episode's intent, and it's somewhat successful.
Absolutely. So I think we should dive straight into the episode now then and look at the episode in a bit more depth. Okay, so the cold open starts with a cargo ship being boarded by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And this is where two shipmates are sent to kill what is classified as the monster, which is revealed to be this woman who is tied up in chains, in the cargo hold. First of all, what do you think to this teaser in the way that it's using the misdirection of this monster and this something's not right with this ship? I mean, including the actual raid on the ship itself is quite fairly methodical and usual for a show to open with something like that. But the misdirection of this monster that they've got in the cargo hold, what did you make to that and the way that it was filmed and gave you that indication that something wasn't quite right?
Well, I'll only bring it up one other time because there's only one other time where I think it's more of an issue is... Probably one of the biggest detriments to this episode is the soundtrack. And as who often likes snow, and I know this is a trope. I mean, this is something that we're going to repeat. We've repeated a lot of the X-Cast and everywhere else, that whenever Mark Snow goes off on these musical motifs that are supposed to be, quote-unquote, more ethnic, encoded that way, they rarely work. And here, it's another issue. I think it's not only the problem that it could be slightly insensitive or offensive, but it's also just doesn't fit the episode, doesn't really fit what's happening in the episode. There's a lot of tragedy and brutality that is given kind of a cartoon sheen by the soundtrack, and that's one thing that bothered me. But overall, this opening cold open, you're right, it isn't anything incredibly unique. Pier 31 in Seattle likely doesn't exist. That's something we can get over, no big deal. But the direction is really well done. I got to give, again, you mentioned All Souls, which I think that's another, considering some of the issues there where they had with timing and everything else, I think a lot of the direction's decent there. And this right out of the gate, it's a pretty directed, fairly standard as a procedural, but it's got energy, it's shot well, the mood's great, the pacing's good. The immigrants are sympathetic, but not like cartoonishly. A lot of other 90s TV shows might have portrayed them a little less human to make them overly sympathetic. And considering the time, I think they did a pretty good job conveying all of that. There's a lot of stuff to distract you once you're not, the monster, something else. You open the door, something horrible could be in there that isn't supernatural. I mean, it's such a dark, depressing space with all the rust. And then to cut to Vivian Wu's character, it's a little X-Files-y, but it's not bad. It doesn't feel very Millennium, but it's not bad. What did you think?
Well, I thought that you mentioned about it's a little X-Files-y. I quite liked it. I think you're saying, as you said, with the not overplaying the immigrant status, I think works quite well, to be fair, to the episode, where it's quite funny. You know, I've been rewatching Fringe of late recently, and it just so happens that I caught an episode called, I think it's Snakehead, from season two, which had a lot of... the Chinese mysticism. It's really strange how, I watched that last night and then obviously had to watch this one this time. But yeah, I thought it was good. It did feel, as I say, the claustrophobicness of the way that it's filmed works quite well, and it's a good way to bring us into the story and bring us into a mysterious element to the show and something which, if I'm going to probably mention this later on in the episode, but when we talk of the likes of The Curse of Frank Black, which does it the other way around, where we see, the flashbacks and the actual ghosts in that episode, which works a lot better than it does here. But we're opening up with a mystery, and it's a fairly decent mystery, to be fair. I mean, what has she done? Why is she a monster? It's not the X-Files. It's not, you're not expecting it to be something majorly supernatural as such, but it does lend the question as to what exactly is going on here, and how is this going to inform the show and inform the episode. The one thing I wanted to touch on, actually, is that you mentioned about the music. Later on in the episode, it wouldn't be by any chance the bit when they're retelling the stories and the bit of the idea of its seduction, was it? Was it around that section that you were thinking about?
That section there actually I have issues with the editing. I think it's
right.
Makes some things unclear. But actually where I was actually referring to is where Frank confronts Tamara
right,
in
okay.
the hospital, and they have their discussion. I just realized probably if you cut out the music, this would be a really good scene. This would harken back to the judge, which it is. This would harken back to powers, principalities, thrones, and dominions, which it is. But instead, it just feels, it undercuts all of the tension, all of the dread, or the power. Because I think one side note is the guest cast in this episode is doing a great job. Vivian Wu is just doing the best with what she's given. Zima, who's Captain Law, does a great job. And Rick Tay, who I looked up on IMDb, because I'd not seen him in anything before. This was his first acting credit. And I think he right. does a great job, especially considering that. And because there's a lot of dialogue hinting at things, especially in that discussion, it really shows some of the production choices in this episode. I think in the season, trying to make it more X-Files, that
yeah.
do not help when you have somebody like Henriksen acting against somebody like Vivian Wu.
Well, one thing I did want to pick up on is when we do come out of the cold open, Frank is brought into this story by Catherine and Jordan, and Catherine's been used a lot more recently in the episodes. You've already mentioned things like Luminary. Again, I'll go back to Owls and Roosters, especially Roosters, where there's the altercation and that Frank and Catherine have, and the reconciliation within those two episodes as well. Do you think it works here that we've had Catherine's inclusion, as especially given that in a couple of episodes' time, we will be getting Amnesis as well, which is an episode that lends to her as and her character. Do you think that this episode serves her well in that sense, and do you feel that they have been trying to include Catherine more as the season's gone on?
I'll try to keep this as non opinionated and controversial as possible, but I think this episode highlights for me why Laura Means does not work a lot in season two, or why Laura Means really represents the show, whether by the network or whether just intentionally by Morgan and Wong, to force it into an X-Files mode when it's not appropriate, or when it's not tonally isn't necessarily the best move to go. Just some of the contrast of the scenes where dialogue is being delivered by Catherine and Megan Gallagher versus when it's being delivered by Laura Means and Kristen Cloak, it feels like two different shows. And this right. script really highlights one of those characters is much better suited, or even one of those actors. I'm not trying to knock Kristen Cloak, but I'm saying for the script and the text here and the themes that are on the page, most of the time, there's a couple scenes where Laura Means works really well, like when they're touring the ship at the beginning. But that's something that really drove home. And there's even some scenes we'll get into later where it's like, why is Kristen being used here? This would be a perfect place for Megan Gallagher. Why is Laura Means being used here when Catherine could be used here? I am happy. I'm somebody who's a big fan of the Catherine character, regardless of how little she's used or how much she was misused in both season one and two. But here it shows again, the more Catherine and the more time she's given to actually do something, the better. That's my long, rambling answer to your good question, and I apologize.
It's okay, because the next thing I was going to ask, actually, with Catherine, I mean, Jordan is adamant, actually, that before I talk about Laura and Frank, is adamant that Frank has to see this woman, that he has to do something. And Catherine takes that on board, and it's something that I wouldn't mind getting some kind of feedback on, really, because there is this reconciliation in Owls and Roosters where they are coming together again, and especially in Owls, where, you know, they started to, it almost felt like a family back then. And he's willing to let Catherine in during the episode. He's willing to let Catherine into the what's happening around him. And with this one, she's finding herself in a position where she doesn't know why she's going to Frank. She doesn't understand why she's suddenly getting these prints offs and why Jordan is saying what she's doing. And it obviously goes back to the fact that Jordan may or may not have this gift, you know, going all the way back to Midnight of the Century, for example. But did from that element there, do you think that and some of the story, I think we can maybe talk about some of the bits that you think may have had a better impact. And I've got a feeling I might know them. I can put them on a bingo card, I think. Where you think that it could, that the scenes are actually working to give them a bit more tight-knittedness to bring them together, bearing in mind that we do know as the season unfolds that things do happen to their relationship as such, without going into any spoiler territory, that we do have this issue with them, and there is this reconciliation that's slowly being formed before the end of season two.
I think that the reconciliation arc is proceeding well. You can even go back to, Luminary, Owls and Roosters, and the transition here, it feels natural. I'm going to say, as the overall production script writing for the season, that's not too forced, and it feels good. The Catherine supporting or indulging Jordan's, inclinations there, whether it's the gift angle, at this point, I think it's very reasonable considering what Catherine has witnessed, whether in Luminary or even going back to Sacrament, that she'd be a little bit more open. And I think that's also handled really well. It's not coming out of nowhere. And even the episode, to its credit, kind of leaves this ambiguity that it could just be the Tamara character or the Siren that is causing both Jordan and Catherine to behave this way. So it gives us that nice space to kind of just let it be and not have to take a hard, fast interpretation, which is when I think Millennium excels.
Yeah, I mean, even in this episode, and it's something I particularly like and adore about TV when it does this, is that you don't get the hard and straight answers. It's problems I have with the X-Files as the X-Files gets into the later seasons, where it becomes very pulpy, very comic booky. You know, they start using terms like super soldiers and things. You know, it becomes a bit Terminator-esque in some ways. Now, don't get me wrong, I love Terminator, but the ambiguity and the being able to make your own mind up or question yourself. I mean, even in this episode, we find at the end that, you know, Franks goes searching for the answer from this woman, and she doesn't have it. She's just posed the question. So I really do appreciate that's the way that they formulate the way that the show runs, and it's to its credit for me in that position. You mentioned Lara, so let's just talk about their relationship at the moment, because both Lara and Frank are in I would suggest a comfortable stage in their relationship together, that they're working relationship is there. We've got Frank on the floor emanating a death scene, death photo. But the conversations that happened throughout the course of this, and you can maybe touch upon the conversations that you were alluding to, which might have been better in Catherine, coming from Catherine rather than Lara. But we've got some of the conversations like we would have in Goodbye Charlie, where Frank's saying that, you know, that Lara is more cynical than he is on the ship, for example. We've got the conversation at the encampment as well, and we've also got the end scene where Lara goes running after Frank to see what he's doing and why he's going back to the encampment, and basically says, "Get back in the car." What did you make of those? You mentioned it's very too showy, that it's almost it's the X-Files at one point and then Millennium in another. But what did you make to their conversations throughout this episode, that there is this commonality between them? They do share a shared issue in a lot of ways with things that we've touched upon in Midnight of the Century, but this is very much just almost like standard conversationalist thing, especially on the ship as well. And what did you make to all those during the course of the episode?
I'm going to be a little critical, but I want to be clear and say, I'm not saying it's necessarily bad or a wrong decision. it's more of a tonal and a flow issue, and depending what someone's preference is and what they're coming to Millennium for. And I think in some ways Lara can be a great character. For example, in Midnight of the Century, the discussion between Peter, Lara, and Frank, I think, works really well. And I think the opening scene with them, where Frank is acting out the scene, the corpse photography on the carpet, yeah. I think that Lara's character can bring out an interesting side of Frank, but it still feels like a different show. And then when they went and do the tour of the boat, because of that, I don't think Frank would say those things that he is saying about the dream and this very abstract, flowery, one-sided argument, and then which then allows Lara to come back and do the flip side argument, and then they make the cynical thing there. It's like, see, this is what this character's like. It doesn't feel natural, and it doesn't feel true to the characters. And it's not so much that what they're saying is bad or it isn't good dialogue. It just doesn't feel like the same show. And it took me out of it a little bit. Again, it's not the end of the world. The thing that really bothered me, though, is the very end where Lara comes driving after in the truck. Like, why would that be her? The script, it doesn't make sense. Frank is leaving the hospital. They would have stopped him. That whole scene right there is, I think, one of the bigger problems of the episode. But that should have been a further confrontation between Frank and Catherine. Lara has nothing to do with this theme-wise, really, at this point. Or at least has much less to do with it. And we don't really understand, like, how would he have gotten out of the hospital, those situations? And then why was he taking... He's not wearing any gloves. And yet he can open the door okay. There's a lot of, like, other little narrative things. Just makes me feel it, as a viewer, it comes even more shoehorned in that, oh... Remember Lara? Yeah, she's better than Catherine. We're gonna put her in. It feels a little bit, this is gonna sound, tone down what I'm about to say, but a little bit like Poochie from The Simpsons, where it's, look at how great, we keep getting reminded of, like, look at how special this character is, and then comparing to Catherine and the rest, and shoehorned into scenes where doesn't necessarily need to be. And I would contrast that with somebody like Emma Hollis, since this episode has so much in common, I think, with Sound of Snow. That tone and that character, I think, works so well for the show. In contrast, just highlights even more how Lara Means feels like an X-Files character. To be fair, season 2 feels a lot like the X-Files, and in that sense, fits in well with Lara Means fits in well with season 2. In a lot of ways. And I don't want to say the character is a failing, but I think sometimes it's very plain, or it feels this way, that you can just tell Morgan and Wong are really shoving in and saying, this is our character. There's a lot of nepotism involved, and I'm just going to shoehorn her in wherever, and I'm going to shoe in the tonality that comes with it. And again, it's not the end of the world, but it just feels a little... cloying might be the word I want to use. I don't know. What are your thoughts after all that?
It's interesting that you say the end scene. I mean, I'll call Full House on my bingo card, because that's what I thought it might be. But I would have liked to have seen that be Catherine, to be fair, because you've got two tracks here. You've got a working relationship and you've got a family relationship. And I think that Darren Mooney said quite a lot over the season that, you know, we've got this familial kind of season arc, this Campbellian heroic thing, and you've got quite a lot of the balls that are being juggled up in the air, and Lara Means being one of them as well, with her own personal story. And I think overall she does work quite well, but I think that you're right that I think it would have been nice for the end of the episode to at least have Catherine be involved, because what was the point in bringing her in and just opening the door for the relationship, for the episode, to bring the episode to Frank, which was a nice way to start it. It was a really nice way to start it, because, you know, it's not going out and actively searching for a case. It's not that someone's had a phone call, Gable House has had a phone call, and, you know, there's this ominous thing that's happening, and Frank needs to go and investigate. It's coming from a more personal point of view, and I appreciate that. But it would not stick in the landing on that conversation, which should be Catherine, and you know, and seeing that the little peaks and troughs of their relationship. So seeing the fact that they are starting to reconnect, but it's still not, the roses still aren't there, I think it would have added weight to the back end of the season as well, being that we're only 5 or 6 episodes from the end as well. I think that would have worked really well to have that, you know, dive more into that. And I think that that's certainly true to what you were saying. I think the also as well that you talked about the death scene, for example, that you mentioned, which is at the beginning. Frank does change his personality in a lot of ways when he's talking to Lara, but he's changed his personality in a lot of ways, full stop, you know, with the whole Bobby Darin stuff and things. So I understand where they were coming from with that, but you don't see enough of that with Catherine, which is unfortunate. I think that had you had more of that, I know that season one goes a long way into, you know, it basically dissolves a relationship into what it became at the beginning of season one. I understand the reasons for that, and I know that people have arguments over, you know, whether or not that was the right thing to do or not, but it is what it is at the end of the day. But it still would have been nice to see that maybe come through a bit more with this episode. And I think you're right with the, especially with that end point, it would have been nice to have that.
It's not so much that it's bad, it's more of where we could shift the focus. So I want to be clear that the Laramine's character isn't a bad idea. It's just sometimes it feels shoehorned into places where it doesn't need to be in a mess. It's sort of like the soundtrack, but it's not that bad. But in that sense of where it changes the color of a scene. And even the scene where Catherine first comes and visits Frank, Laura's there. She doesn't need to be there. And on one hand, it adds like there's a different dynamic and there's kind of this uncomfortable feeling. And to give the show a lot of credit, thank goodness it never went to the will they, won't they dynamic or make Catherine jealous. It just is kind of there, but it still also doesn't really need to be. And then the discussion between Frank and Catherine about the situation feels different, and it changes what I think it should be and could allow them to really connect as a character, considering that's what this, like we've been talking about, where this episode sort of is in the longer arc about the relationship. But they just put put Laura in the background, and she makes a few awkward comments, and then she goes and sits like a college kid in a chair and kind of sits there awkwardly. Why? What is this adding? And that's sort of the repeated thing, I guess I'm trying to say, that I feel Morgan and Wong do with the character. Even if there are a lot of good things to go with the character, I think sometimes, and you know, without spoilers going ahead in the resolution of the series, I think it's even echoed further that there's a prioritization that hinders what I think could have provided a better flow to the resolution of this family arc. But it's not a disaster. It's nothing else. But we're having a little fun nitpicking and not slagging off the whole episode here. So.
No, I mean, I'd say, I mean, I think Lara's a great, personally, I think she's a fantastic character, but I do understand your criticisms and your nitpicking of it, because I do get it. I do understand that, you know, that I think the Goodbye Charlie and this one kind of has, echoes each other, I think, in a lot of ways, because some of the communication, the talks that Lara and Frank have about the nature of the group and the nature of the coming apocalypse and stuff like that is really strong, and you've got Midnight of the Century, which is really strong. But that doesn't mean that the two can't coexist, like sort of Luminary, for example, where, you know, Catherine is, you know, talking to Peter about stuff, and you know, we get there's other scenes as well throughout the season and throughout season one in some ways as well, where, you know, we've got the familial kind of aspect to it, and I think, you know, you can have all your cakes and eating it. But I think what you're saying is true, that there's putting Lara or putting Kristen Cloak in for the sake of putting her in to a scene which doesn't really need it and only feels there just to inform us that they know each other, ready for amnesis. That's the only way that I can potentially see it. That's the only reason why that bit is there. And I don't quite get or understand the awkwardness, to be fair. It doesn't seem to be something that really resonates with me from that. I thought that was a bit off and a bit awkward, actually, from a viewing point of view. I didn't really quite get that. One of the things I wanted to talk about is this: the middle section of where, before we get into Tamara and speak about her in more detail, is there's a really interesting section which I quite enjoy from a structural point of view, and it's the storytelling with the crewmates. For me, it's well done. It starts with the ship's captain, and then the story continues on with the shipmates before we circle back around to the end story with the captain again. But what did you make of the content, the kind of the narrative kind of switching up there that they did there? But now we're getting into this kind of ethereal ghost story of how did she come onto the ship? Where did she come from? Why do people have so many different narrative stories about her and how she came about? And the different narratives and the viewpoints that people are seeing regarding her, and the actual structure of the way that it's being told as well. How did you view that?
I think overall it works fairly well. And again, I think it goes back to the acting. They've got a good guest cast who are able to sell the story. And it's fairly well directed. There are some issues with the editing that makes some of the transitions a bit unclear. But that's okay, because it's sort of dream logic scene anyways. Especially the scene where the captain first, you know, goes out on the boat, out on the deck, and shines the light in the water. It's really atmospheric, and I got to give that scene quite a bit of credit. I want to kind of jump back a little bit, because I think prior to this, we get a shot of Tamara tasting her IV blood needle and then licking her wrist. And they don't really go anywhere with that. Now, they don't need to, but I wanted to see what you thought, in the sense of, I thought that was kind of queuing to go somewhere with that in the end, but it's just sort of there as an unsettling marker, or maybe it does connect, or maybe it's another one of those, what are we dealing with here? We're going to give you multiple options.
Yeah, I made a note of that, actually. I did make a note of it, because it was one of those scenes where blink and you miss it, and I did catch it, and I was like, I'm not quite sure why that was put there. What was the, you know, were we indicating there was some sort of Legion aspect to her? I mean, we're going to talk about Tamara in a bit anyway about that, but you know, is it just there to unsettle, which is the way that I kind of perceived it, or it has to be? I don't know about the history of this episode, actually, with regards to the writing of it, but it feels like it's two separate stories in some ways. And was there script issues, or was the draft issues that may had included something on there, or was it purely just to unsettle? That's the way that I felt watching that scene, was it was designed to give you that unsettledness, that feeling of who is she, what is she, why is she doing that, and you know, what could she be? That's the way that I saw it anyway.
I think I took it away as a similar idea of perhaps it's allowing to either, oh, it's a vampiric thing, or it's a going back to the earlier motifs of possession and something else, because we're dealing with a person. Well, I'm not even going to say an entity, because that, you know, maybe goes a little too far. We're dealing with a person who is interpreted in multiple ways in manipulating people and doing things and what their form is and all the rest. So I felt it worked okay, because I thought the direction was restrained. And I think also the acting was restrained. That's another thing. And a lot of, especially the earlier scenes, Vivian Wu could have camped it up a lot, and especially in that scene could have, but just played it very nonchalant. And then when everybody walks in, very casual, doesn't overly hide it. So I think the scene works just to create mystery, and that's fine. So overall, I think it does. And then when it gets to the three storytelling, or the three storytellers, I think. Or is it? No, it's the two storytellers. But they're telling three different events, I think, roughly. It's a big jumbled mess of stories. And I think that also helps just create a lot of confusion. And maybe the editing being the way it is and making it difficult to follow what's happening when and all the rest is part of the charm and part of the attempt. So I think it's successful.
I mean, I took it as that. I did take, that's why I was saying about the structure. I think I took it as that, you know, you'll see this in a lot of TV shows. I'm trying to think of an X-File example. Let's say Jose Chung from Outer Space, for example, where you've got a long shot of a character that's talking down the lens. And then when you've come back to it, it's actually a different scene. and it's designed to throw you off that mark. And, you know, that's obviously a Darren Morgan episode, but Rob Bowman directed that as well. But the actual way that that's done, that the storytelling is meant to be a point of view narrative, and the whole, it's not just that us being informed of it, they're actually using the device, the storytelling device, and the direction to throw us off. And I think that personally, that's the way that I saw that scene, and I actually really like that aspect of it.
And I think it fits in well with what happens later. So your point is well made. Without going away too further, but when it comes to Frank's own vision and the transition there. So good point.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a couple of lines. I know we talked about the script before, but there's a couple of lines I wanted to bring up. Things like where during that story, they start talking about within the episode of like a scream caught in a smile, mm-hmm. and that humans always gravitate towards light. What did you make to those little elements that they're using? It's almost like human nature. I know we'll talk about the alternative reality aspect and the kind of It's a Wonderful Life thing a bit later, but there's an ambiguity to even that. The fact that, you know, there's somebody can be screaming in horror or, you know, freezing to death as the case may be in this one with the four dead bodies. But also the fact that, you know, that humans will always gravitate to the light. What did you make to those kind of dark and light remarks that are made?
They work for the most part because of the way they're contextualized in the story, but it seems fairly apparent that they're also supposed to pattern on to Frank Black and his relationship with the Millennium Group. I think it generally works. Also, a lot of the stuff in that scene, I think, is if it doesn't entirely work, quote unquote, to the viewer, it still is passable because it's being done, like you said, it's a point of view narrative, and it's also very tropey. It can be a little uncomfortable in the sense that there's a lot of some stereotyping happening, but, you know, or how could you say, racial or cultural tropes. I don't know, stereotyping may be an extreme, but some tropes in a sense. Other than that, though, I think everything else can be pretty well excused, and I don't think it's too far, even if it is supposed to map on to Frank. I don't think it goes too far. I think it's generally fairly successful being generalized and analogous to that story, and if you want to extend it further, great. And I think this is also an example where Laura works really well in the episode, is her interactions with them, and then the comment about misogyny in the supernatural and how that's handled and delivered. I think Kristen Cloak did a really good job in that scene. So I have to throw that out there before I sound too negative. I'm not an anti-Laura person. And like you mentioned, Goodbye Charlie, Monster, some of these, and Midnight of the Century, she's an excellent addition.
Yeah, it is interesting to say that when she does say that misogyny, she says blame the woman, which I thought was a nice little nod there. I thought that was quite well delivered. I think we need to talk about Tamara Swayfar Lee, I think. Because we do get into what I would consider the second part of this episode, because the first part is kind of, you know, we've got this mysterious thing that's happening. We've now got this point of view storytelling. And, you know, we move into the second part, which is effectively Frank having his own It's a Wonderful Life story. And there's elements within the story itself. There's a couple of things that I wanted to mention, actually, with the first time we see Tamara with Frank. And some of the directional issues and photography stuff that they did, that there's an orange, a great orange hue that's around Tamara when Frank first sees her. Mm-hmm. And then later in the scene, later in the episode, sorry, when he does go down this the new alternative reality, that it's bathed in that orange light as well. And I thought that was a really interesting take and a nice thematic, you know, it's like typical going back in history with black and white, for example, but this orange light gave it that feel of, you know, echoing the Yellow House in some ways, didn't it? And also the fact that, you know, it's linking the two together. What did you make to that? Just that before we talked more deeply into Tamara's little story here.
Good catch. I didn't connect the lighting on her in the hospital room, with the later. I just figured, you know, the orange tint is just a way to kind of show a warm dream logic. But that's a fun catch.
Well, thank you. but yeah, so that was something that I caught onto there. But I do like the, as I say, the the dream logic kind of aspect that you alluded to there, and the fact that, you know, it is the yellow house that he's living in, and the orange tint kind of helps to give you that feel, that glow and that the kind of sunshine and the feeling that you are in a better place in some ways. It's very light and very kind of relaxing, which I thought was particularly good. And we'll get into the actual content of that in a minute. Yeah, so first off, I mean, as a concept, this wonderful life differing path story, which Frank is taken to another reality. It seems the actual, just a brief overview of it, it seems that it will still be eventually invaded by evil within or without the Millennium Group. With Millennium Group's present there or the not, then evil will be invaded into it. I mean, I suppose that's a subjective matter, when whether or not you perceive Frank's mind is doing the invasion, and that the fears that Frank has with the fact that Jordan unfortunately gets killed in what looks like Frank's basement, which is not the best place in the world for anyone at the moment. But this idea that Jordan, you know, in this alternative reality, either everything is going smoothly and it is Frank's mind that takes it back there, or is it the pervasion of evil that will eventually get to the Yellow House, no matter what reality he's in? And then that kind of goes back to right at the very end when, you know, he's wanting the answer from Tamara. But what did you make to that kind of overview of the way that they portrayed this alternative reality and the invasion of evil and how that transpired? How did you view it? That's the way I viewed it. It was Frank's mind that was actually fighting against that, fighting against the reality of what he was seeing. And unfortunately, his mind goes down there. But what did you make to it? How do you view it?
I think you're right on the money with the interpretation that, you know, he is subconsciously trying to figure out what is happening or work against it. There are two elements of it that are more production that don't work, and then everything else I'll speak about. The one is the Chinese food dinner thing is a little on the nose. It's okay, it's a dream sequence. And then when I first watched it, I was like, okay, this is too on the nose. But I thought, well, you're actually introducing a hallucination in a dream so suddenly. I think it actually might work okay because the transition is so jarring to kind of cue to the audience that something is off that early on. So I actually went back on my initial thought and said, oh, maybe that does work. And then the other thing is the use of the demon suit. Production-wise, it looks a little rough. And I'm not sure it was entirely necessary, but that's okay. It kind of goes back to the Curse of Frank Black, and I think the fact that they've been using it in that way of sort of just symbolically representing this threat and danger, and maybe the hearkening, like you're mentioning, to Bletcher's death in the basement and everything else.
And the old man as well.
Correct. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Although, I just was thinking of everything related with Legion, but yes, that's right. This is actually something about the episode that I think is underappreciated by myself when I first watched it and rewatched it again. And it goes back to that discussion that they have in the hospital scene. If there wasn't the soundtrack, I think it would have come through a lot better. Because what is, I think, the best line in the episode is, it's not to it yet, but she says, or Frank asks, is this a seduction? She says, is it working? He says, not in the least. And this, I think, is the nice line here. She says, then keep thinking. And it kind of goes back to what you were talking a little bit about earlier, and then also how it ends up about the ambiguity and how this works so well for in the point of where it is in the season. And I think this is where the episode needs to be defended. This is how I think it's actually very successful, even if it is a little bit obtuse, is what is actually happening? What is the threat? The threat is Frank overthinking the situation, him attempting through ego to be able to control it and solve it himself. It's one of those tricks of cults that you can keep people to keep spinning on these wheels of unanswerable questions. Is the Millennium Group good for me in this situation? Hypothetical, is it bad for me? Is my family going to be this? Is it that? And it's just allowing him to either confuse himself or put in the situation. So it's not necessarily the sense that the thinking is the problem, but I think the thing that they're emphasizing is thinking within the context of this cult. And yeah. whether I'm taking this too far or not, I don't know. But it seems to fit. That just seems to be the natural interpretation based on where it is in the season. And I think it works really well, even if it does have a lot in common with The Sound of Snow. And to be fair, it kind of I'm connecting it to, not so much on its own, but I'm contextualizing it when Frank at the end says, I heard what I wanted to hear. She was sent here to tempt me about my life. She didn't have the answer. What all she did was push him to think about something that he's already anxious and obsessed with the promise that there's actually a solution that you can do simply by dwelling and obsessing over it. That's similar to, I think, what was with Peter Watts in his character arc. And so, and even what with Lara, without going into spoilers. So I think there's some nice connections to where the show has been and then where it's going to go.
It's going.
With that whole stuff. And I think that, give the show credit, Millennium often does this, it doesn't front a lot of its, I think, more interesting themes. It kind of lets them sit in the background. And I was surprised when I watched this and realized, oh, this is another one where I think it gets overshadowed by a lot of the other mess on top of the episode when there is the good family reconciliation arc and there is this presentation of themes from season one, especially going back to powers, principalities, and the judge, and reframing it with the character here, and then even into season three with Sound of Snow.
The one thing that I actually think, and I've got down, which actually my next question actually is that the fact that they have this good and evil debate was an interesting one, especially it's been brought up as the beginning and the end. Is a flashback that we get. And I feel that in some ways that this is almost an attempt to be the almost like the third part of a three-parter in like The Curse of Frank Black and Midnight of the Century, that the, you know, you've got the ghost in The Curse of Frank Black and you've got this character now, as you say, he's making him think about where he is and where he was. You mentioned about these Legion elements, the, you know, principalities, thrones and dominions in there with Alistair Pepper. And the judge, and all of these things that are seeded in that you don't necessarily need to focus in on so much. But what Millennium does really well is it seeds in quite a lot of these different elements. As I say, you know, like Lara's story, like Frank's journey. You've got Peter's journey over the course of season three and what happens to him. I felt it could have been done better. I felt that there was more to this. If we were given more time to breathe, Tamara could have been used slightly better. But it's still at the same point. It's almost like alternative reality that's been handed to Frank, this decision that he has to make, which he will be making by the end of season two. You know, it is a chance for him to stop and think, and what would life be without the Millennium Group? Is that possible? And if you take it the way that I read it and the way that you would agree with me on, that it is Frank's own mind that's invading what it could be or what it could have been, where he is at this moment in time. It's a really interesting concept to think about whether or not that is at all possible. I know we know what happens, but is that at all possible in where he is, but what has happened to him? And then you talk about the Sound of Snow. I know I won't go into too much detail on The Sound of Snow, but it's really interesting how subconsciously I actually thought about that watching this episode today. And it's one of those passing thoughts where you think, I can't remember exactly where it was. It's the cassette tape, when he's playing the cassette tape back. And that sparked like, oh, that's a bit like Sound of Snow. But then it disappeared. It didn't linger in my mind long enough to put the two together. But it's interesting how that this episode looks forward at what potentially will happen or could happen or what could have happened. And The Sound of Snow looks back. Again, it's very similar. It's kind of looks back at a particular moment in time and just sees an alternative reality to that. So I think that's a really interesting, insightful thing to think about. It makes the episode like a part of something that's bigger, and making it bigger, it's just a sum in that, all of its parts. And I think that is something that, you know, taken out of context and watching this episode as a one piece, yes, it may not be the best episode in the world, and it isn't, but it has its problems. But at the same time, in the grander scheme of things, I think it works really well.
Also, just on that, without getting into too many spoilers, but the interesting thing is, when I was on The Sound of Snow tip, there's too many things that are similar that make me think it was intentional. by the producers. Mm-hmm. And I would love to, if Chip Johansson does one of those Ask Me Questions like Spotnitz did about season two, which is so awesome of him to do, by the way. It's a side note. Because we have the connection to Greek mythology. We have the siren, and then the character, without spoiling, one of the main characters in Sound of Snow is named after Charon. And then you've also got car-related, sound-related hallucinations. We have almost dying of exposure. There's a lot of parallels. And your point there about, you know, looking into the past and looking to the future, focusing on here, there's something there. And going back to your other question about just the overall, how does it fit in some of the things and its importance? The idea for me is to think about where it's at in the season, and I think it is a little muddled, but I think it fits really well also connected with Luminary in that Frank's journey there and kind of what happens, and he starts coming back down or starts either going up the mountain or coming back down from the mountain. And here, on one hand, I'm watching this and saying this is a little too redundant, but then I went back and thought of that opening line of you've been a victim of a terrible loss, and you have to give yourself time to grieve. And I think that's a really nice writing trick then on that sense to allow them to explore this further and to kind of give the viewers this attempt that, yeah, this isn't a quick journey, and this may have some repetitive moments and motifs and feelings of things that we've seen and we may see again, but that is the way it is. And then introducing on Catherine, who is a therapist and all the rest, I think it plays out much more elegantly than I gave it credit for.
Even by discussing this on this podcast, I mean, that's what's great about doing podcasts, is that you will necessarily go through some episodes which, you know, might start out as, oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
And then the more you talk about it, the more that you appreciate it more, and you know, you go away thinking about the episode in a different way. And next time you watch it or rewatch it, then, you know, think of those in mind, and that's certainly something that we will do. Other than that, really, there's a couple of things. Just before the actual scene, actually, where he does have the dream sequence, which is quite signposted when you look back on it, is when Frank gets out of the car and then sits down by the side of the road and does this gesture with his hands, then gets up and goes again, which is obviously the change into the dream sequence. And also the fact that he becomes this obsessed. I know we've briefly talked about Lara going after him in the car, but what did you think of his obsession when he comes out of the dream state and his need to see Tamara and the things that he does up until the end, where he eventually finds that she doesn't have the questions. It's only the questions that she's posing. What did you make to that final sequence there?
Similarly to some of the other things, I think it works because of the ambiguity, because we're allowed to motivate or to interpret Frank's behavior as being motivated by the siren. So, and whether that is you want to take it as being just his own drive and paranoia and anxiety about his situation in the group, and going back to the question, who am I? This is who we are. You know, you have a wife and daughter who love you, and obsessing about this character and from a script and a narrative point, or it's simply he's just being tempted to the rocks like the other sailors, or to the waters to die of exposure. I mean, because I think it's also signposted by the very end, maybe a little bit on the nose, not to keep using that phrase, but, you know, he gets injured and he finally comes to his senses when his ear is injured and his ear is bleeding. And that's one of the final shots we get of him. So I think the script is really trying to, I think, lean on the side that he's being controlled by Tamara.
I think also within that scene, there's one line which is said in the encampment where it's said that her voice is the lure of death's sweet call, which is quite lyrical. I quite like the actual lyricalness of that. This lure of death's sweet call, and not only Frank, but everyone else has gone through this situation. I think it's the final thing I want to ask is what did you make to the fact that, you know, Frank survives this, the other four don't, and how that is interplayed with this idea that it's her doing when it's not, it's their choice to make that decision. And then also the fact that she seems to be at the very end, like her job is done, and she seems to be quite almost a scared character. And again, it can come back to being the ambiguity stage as well. As has whatever's been done, has it been, you mentioned the possession kind of thing before with the blood on the IV drip, has the job been completed? There seems to be this element of the mission statement for Tamara was to get to Frank to offer him this reality. So what did you make to those elements there?
It's ambiguous, but I think your interpretation is the one that the episode seems to support the most, and I would lean to there that Tamara is not just simply this mysterious antagonist, but potentially is just a person who is, whether it's possessed or it's from mysterious circumstances, but we don't know about the origins, that disappeared 10 years ago, likely died, but is behaving this way. So the episode leans very supernatural, that it's likely, yeah, that, but then it ends on the sense that it's a very normal situation and that Frank was able to get out of the situation. And this is one reason why I'm really frustrated that it should have been Catherine and not Lara at the end, because the only reason he survives really is because of other people who are around him. Yeah. That's it. If he was out on a boat, he would have been dead just like everybody else. And if it wasn't for Catherine, or again, this situation, if it wasn't for Lara, really, he and probably the other, maybe he still would have been fine. But I mean, he's walking by himself. He probably would have died also. And that's where, mm-hmm, I think it narratively, thematically, should have been Catherine in that scene. In addition to the fact that I think Lara's exposition dump is a little, takes away from the power of the scene. But I went off on a tangent from your initial question, and I'll turn it over to you.
What overall then, looking back on the episode and what we've discussed here with the various elements, is there anything else that I've missed that you want to bring up? Is there anything that you feel needs to be looked into a bit more, in a bit more depth? Or are you quite happy with our overview, our coverage of today's episode?
I had a lot of fun chatting, but it's been a while since I've been able to say this out loud. And I'm going to say here that Giebelhaus is always welcome in Millennium. And it was great. Sometimes he can be a little cartoonish, but I mean, here's, yeah, like the perfect amount. Put him in, get a little bit of Giebelhaus attitude, and then get out. And it was great to see him again.
But yeah, are you up to anything at the moment? And if people are wanting to get in touch or to see what you're up to, where can people find you online?
A, thanks for letting me talk about the episode. And B, really pretty much the best place would be, is I'm often in the group on Facebook. You know, I'll check that. And then also the Patreon zone and for the XCast basement too. So that's generally where I'll spend most of any time related to this. And a lot of great people there. If you're not already hanging out and chatting, please come hang out.
Excellent. Yes. Okay. So you can find me on Twitter at R Muldrake. It's RMULDRAKE. I'm on various different podcasts at the moment. So you can find the first two seasons of Pick Up a Podcast, which has literally just finished with a episode with myself talking to Tony Black, of all people. So feel free to go back into that repertoire, that library, and that you can find that on Twitter at Pick Up a Podcast. And also, I'm also on another venture with Tony at the moment, which is the Make It So, a Star Trek Universe podcast, which can be found on Twitter again at Jean-Luc Podard. We'll also have some clips of other We Made This podcasts coming at the end of this episode, just to give you a little taster of what we've been doing over the last few weeks. So stay back for that. But other than that, again, thank you very much, Russ, for coming on.
Thank you.
This is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. The Movie Palace.
All right then, so Some Like It Hot. So yeah, I think the thinking here was just that, I mean, we did the lockdown episode last week. I thought it'd be good to do something lighthearted for, yeah, the first full film discussion back. And I thought, you know, Some Like It Hot was a very strong contender to be that film. So what are your general thoughts on the film? And, like, this wasn't your first watch, was it? I think this is one you'd seen a while ago, is that right?
Yes, that's true. I'd have to look at Letterboxd probably to pin down when I first saw the film, because that's how I, yeah, keep track of my film watching. But it was some years ago, I think. I think it was around 5-6 years ago, maybe longer.
Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
I think it's what is it the whole like Peter's like
about Peter being a bit of a nomad.
I think it's just Peter overreacting a little bit.
I think he definitely overreacts, but I think it's a really good. It's a good interaction between these two, and it's a good scene. And I have to admit, I really like Joshua Jackson when he gets kind of intense like that.
Yeah.
For the majority of this show, he's like that as well. But in this scene, I really love.
We dig music.
Ben Folds, or Benjamin Scott Folds, is an American singer-songwriter, musician, composer, and record producer from Chapel Hill in North Carolina in America.
North Carolina.
It is. It's sort of in between North and South. That's why it's North.
Yes. Many people would say Middle, not Colin.
Snorth. I think Snorth is a better word than Middle.
Yeah.
I think Middle's overrated. We'll go with Snorth.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.